And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Three times in four games, Spurs have scored four goals, four times in six games, and five times in eight games. Gareth Bale has 6-6, Harry Kane has 5-7. And Spurs are becoming the attacking machine we always dreamed of. It makes you wonder what the fuss was all about. Hello, my name is Jack Pitbrook and you're listening to the View from the Lane podcast. I'm joined today by James Moore. James, you must be absolutely buzzing after another destruction of Crystal Palace yesterday evening at White Hart Lane.
Yeah, I don't know what people were complaining about. Why? What was all that negativity a few weeks ago from people? It seems misplaced.
Baffling negativity. Cool.
It's really good. I really enjoyed the game. Just as a sort of 90 minutes in, forget all the context, just as a 90 minutes of football in isolation. I mean, I've seen a few conversations in the last couple of weeks about, in fact, it may have been you that tweeted it, apologies if it was, but someone tweeted, how many genuinely good and entertaining games have you seen in the last few weeks? And the answers were generally not many. But I actually thought that was a good game, not just because Spurs won. I thought it was, I thought Palace are pretty good, actually. I think they could probably feel slightly hard done to come away with a 4-1 defeat. It's good to get a little bit of mild peril in there. I know that makes it sound a bit like a kind of kids' film, but it's quite good to kind of have that moment in the second act where it looks like it's all going to go wrong. And, I can't think of an example from a kids' film now.
Like in Superbad, when they're not going to make it to the party?
Yeah, like that. That's the first film you thought of. Especially when I was talking about kids' films, and that film has a lot of indoor language in it.
I just love Superbad. It's not really a reference for anything like this.
It's very funny. It might be one of the last DVDs I ever bought.
Don't need it on DVD. It's always on television. It's literally always on television.
Is it one of those ITV3 ones? It's always on.
I think so, yeah.
Hot Fuzz. Hot Fuzz is always on ITV3 or ITV4.
Yeah.
This is really one for the international audience again. Anyway, very good performance. I very much enjoyed it. It was good to see. I'm always encouraged when I see Spurs win a game when there has been that bit of adversity. Burnley was very impressive and I really enjoyed that. But to actually see Spurs get pegged back and then comprehensively win the game when you thought maybe they might have been sort of put on the back foot a little bit, I thought it was really impressive. And I've seen quite a few tweets from Spurs fans sort of justifying the result or picking up the results on the basis of the opposition. Purely, I think, because they're worried that people are saying it's only Palace, it's only Burnley, it's only Fulham. But looking at those teams' other results in the last few weeks sort of speaks for itself, really, doesn't it? You've seen Fulham go and win at Anfield on Sunday afternoon. Palace drew with Manchester United in midweek. Burnley drawn with Arsenal and Leicester in the last sort of 10 days or whatever. So they're not the three best teams in the Premier League, but they are teams who are capable of getting results against the decent sides. So I think Spurs should be very happy with the way that last week has gone. And we said before Burnley that it was off the back of the West Ham game that it was absolutely crucial that if they would have any chance of getting into the top four, they would need 9 points in those three games, and they've gone and done it, I think, in really convincing style. So you can only be satisfied with that.
I agree with you. I don't think it's right to say it's only Burnley, Fulham and Palace that they've beaten, given that, well, Palace and Fulham were two of the teams who they've had these like four killer one alls, which I think really undermined their season. And Spurs have comprehensively managed to avoid doing that again in the last few days. If Spurs had still got the points from that run of one-alls, then they would currently be on 53 points with the game in hand on Leicester, with the capacity to go second. So I don't think we should put too much context on this that we like ignore the way in which this was a really, really good win. Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 per month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/SpursPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. I want to start by talking about Gareth Bale. I think Bale is probably the, you know, we can argue whether or not he was the man of the match, but I think he's the most interesting Spurs player right now. We know that Kane's a great player and we know that Son is a very good player, but Bale is doing something different at the moment, which is he's surprising people. He's surprising me. Like, I didn't think, you know, with the Brighton game, for example, a month or two ago, I didn't think Bale was capable of playing this well again.
Yeah, definitely.
Of putting in the kind of physically dominant frontline performance that he's putting in right now. And I thought, you know, he's obviously fantastic in the Burnley game. Two goals, brilliant diagonal assist for Kane. And then I thought he was pretty good in the Fulham game, which we'll come to in midweek. Then I thought he was fantastic again yesterday, James. Lots of stuff stands out. That run he made for the first goal, bursting into the box to get on the end of Kane's cross from the left. That's just like, that's proper, you know, aggressive, anticipating centre-forwards play. It reminded me a little bit of Jumba Lucas's goal, the second goal of the Mourinho era, when Spurs won 3-2 at West Ham in 2019. Just that you kind of cross from the left and then attacker comes in from outside the box to like burst towards the far post to stick it in. So that was great. And then the second goal, that header, that was a proper like Ronaldo-y centre-forwards header. Totally. He absolutely destroyed Kouyaté, and Kouyaté's a pretty big guy. So, and like, you don't score that goal unless you are really confident, on top of your own game. So yeah, I just got such a good feeling watching Bale yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this earlier in the season, like how Spurs needed another goal scorer in the team. And you just really see the difference. And, you know, we know how good Kane is on the ball. We know how good his delivery is. But when he's only really able to give the ball to Son, it makes it so much more like restrictive, the way Spurs had to play in order to make that work. I.e. Kane would have to be quite deep and Son would have to kind of be effectively like on the shoulder of the last defender trying to make that run through. And obviously, they both have the intelligence and the ability to make that work quite often. And, you know, it obviously worked quite a lot in the first few months of the season. But it always felt like, and I mean, I think when things turned, probably one of the things they were missing was like a sort of in-game plan B. And I think just having Bale in the team just gives you so much more in an attacking sense. And, you know, I'm sure if you wanted to be really critical, you could say it doesn't necessarily always do a shift defensively. And I think I tweeted in criticism of Matt Doherty for not closing down. Was it Milivojevic who put the cross in, I think? Doherty didn't close him down. And he kind of gave him that extra sort of second and a half to compose himself and swing that ball into Benteke. But a few people in reply to that tweet did point out, and I don't think this is necessarily incorrect or unfair, that Bale had kind of sort of given up the cause there in the build-up to that goal as well. So, you know, I'm sure someone who put so much emphasis on defensive play, like Mourinho, would have noticed that. But when you're adding so much to the attack and you're so involved in, you know, not just like finishing those two moves, and I'll come on in a second to, you know, the fact that he's basically playing as a number nine almost now. I mean, you know, he's got the number nine in the back of his shirt with the goals he's scoring. I think four of the five he scored in the league have basically been sort of in the six-yard box between the width of the post, I think, which I don't know if that's necessarily what we expected, but it is obviously very useful.
That's a really good point, because both against Burnley and against Wolfsburg AC, he scored almost identical goals, running in basically from the right-hand side towards the middle of the box, then hitting that first-time shot with his left foot that kind of whips into the far corner. And then he scored his first goal against Burnley, was that kind of dart towards the keeper and prodding in that Sonny's cross in. And then since then, he scored a goal running towards the far post to get on the end of Kane's flash across the box on Sunday. And then he scores the big header off Kane's kind of far post setup header. They're all either coming in from maybe slightly from the right-hand side, coming towards the goal type goals. They're a little bit like, they're kind of like the sort of goals that Raheem Sterling would score for City back when he was playing on the right. So yeah, I think he's looking really good. And it means that obviously with Bale in those areas, that means that Kane can play a little bit deeper. And Son, I think, is playing, I'd like to actually, you know, get on those graphics which shows you this, but Son seems to be playing further and further out on the left-hand side. I feel like Son is getting in the box less at the moment. Son is playing more of a kind of left winger. In a way, was Bale isn't really playing that wide that much. Bale, I think, is attacking the box a bit more. Well, that's certainly my impression watching.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, it has felt like Son's influence has sort of been a little bit more limited in the last few games. I've obviously did get the assist for Kane's second goal last night. So, you know, it's not like he's been completely marginalised. And, like, you know, you mentioned he set up that Kane goal, Bale goal, against Burnley. And the own goal, I guess, at Fulham. So having said that, he obviously clearly has to be making quite a big contribution. But I think it feels like that doesn't feel like Bale coming into the team. I mean, I could have read this completely wrong, but it doesn't feel like it's like putting noses out of joint or whatever. I mean, I did see Steven Bergwijn sat on the bench last night and kind of, he didn't look especially happy, which isn't great, but I don't think you could have too many complaints that Bale was getting those minutes now ahead of him. I mean, he's made such a big difference in the last few weeks. And again, as we were saying last week, not just in terms of what he's actually, look, what his output has been in terms of goals and assists, but just in the way he's kind of changed the vibe a little bit. Just feels like a lot of attention has been lifted. And that always comes when you get a couple of good results, but it just feels like suddenly everyone's a bit more relaxed. There's a bit more kind of fluidity in the way they're playing. Like, they didn't panic when they got pegged back yesterday. Yeah. Like, maybe they would have done a month or so ago had that happened. You know, you'd maybe think they would have lost that game, particularly with Zaha coming on at half time. You know, you look at it and think maybe they would have kind of really struggled to create again. But it's just transformed it, really. I mean, it does, you know. You could argue all day long over whether or not he should have been in the team earlier. I guess we'll never really know whether or not the right moment was actually in November or December or January rather than late February. But regardless, I mean, it puts Spurs in a very good position now, I think, to end the season well. It's Chelsea-Everton on Monday night as we record this evening. So, you know, if you say Chelsea win that game, which I suspect they probably would, they'd be, what, 5 points off with your game in hand, fourth. Which, you know, doesn't sound great, but I think from where they were a few weeks ago, it definitely is a big improvement. It's a bit of a shame, I think, that Leicester and Man United won over the weekend.
Yeah.
Kind of had expectations that maybe Leicester wouldn't win and that United would lose, and then we'd be kind of saying, 6 points off second with a game in hand, and that feels like you really are back in it. I do kind of think both of those two teams might wobble a little bit between now and the end. Whether it's quite enough for Spurs, I guess I'm not so sure. But, I mean, to at least be kind of, to borrow an old phrase, putting the pressure on is an improvement on where we expected to be kind of 2-3 weeks ago.
Totally. I think the big story in the last month or so has been the fluidity of those. I mean, we'll come on to the league later on, but the fluidity of those kind of top eight positions. Like, nobody would have expected the Liverpool collapse since Christmas. Chelsea are having a surge under tactics Tom. Man United and Leicester both looked a little bit wobbly, but I think might stabilise. Everton, it's still hard to get a read on Everton. I don't know if they will start to feel the pressure the closer they get. So it really is all to play for.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
One special moment I want to look at specifically, which I absolutely loved, the Harry Kane goal. I think that's probably my favourite Spurs goal this season. I'd be willing to listen to other suggestions. I mean, the Ndombele goal at Sheffield United is probably the only other rival.
Yeah.
What I liked about the Harry Kane goal was just the uniqueness. Like, for me, uniqueness is such a good thing in a goal. I've never really seen anything like it. Like, there was the Yaya Toure goal when City beat, I'm showing my bias here, when City beat Sunderland in the League Cup final in 2014.
Well, let me flip that bias back on you and say Gareth Bale at the Etihad in that that game, that scandalous game where Balotelli and Lescott both should have been sent off.
Oh, yeah, the 3-2.
Yeah, he it's like an inverted image of that. He obviously, with his left foot, the other side of the box, swept across it, across Europa League hero Joe Hart into the back of the net.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's
quite
good
similar
point.
To that, I think.
Yeah, it had that same trajectory. And because what I loved about Kane yesterday is that, and this is again a really cool thing in football, is when a player does something which nobody, I mean, there was only 100 people in the ground anyway, but assuming the ground would have been full, nobody in the ground would have thought, go on, whip that into the top corner when that Doherty's pass was travelling towards him. It was just, it's, and I was really lucky because I had a perfect view in the press box. We had the perfect view of the ball, and it was one of those where as soon as he hit it, it was obviously in, like in that split second, because the way it just accelerated up and away from Areola. And then it goes in and you're like, what's just happened? What happened there? And then you can watch on the little screen. And being surprised is just the coolest thing in football. As someone who, if you watch football and something happens that you weren't expecting to happen, it's the best. So, I'm full of admiration for that goal. I think that and Ndombele at Sheffield United, I think, are the two standouts for me. Even though Spurs will have scored better team goals, combination goals, great moves, great passes, but just for like weirdness and uniqueness, the Kane goal and the Ndombele goal are my two favourites.
Can I give you another couple?
Please.
Son against Arsenal.
The long range one.
That was sick. Son against Arsenal. Aurier at Old Trafford with that ball from Højbjerg.
That was great.
An incredible ball. And like, it was the fifth goal of the game, and I think the moment that I realised Spurs might actually win. Probably one on a Bale once in the last, like, I mean, he's got obviously the two goals he talked about, the Wolfsburger one, and the Burnley one, the two similar ones that you mentioned. But actually, the one away in Wolfsburger, where Doherty plays the through ball and Bale kind of cuts it back, like with that really sort of jagged first touch, and then strikes it from quite a, like, basically overpowers the goalkeeper from like quite a tight angle. But that drag back is so like brutally, I don't know what it is about it, but it's really like sharp. And I don't know whether that might just have been a moment that he kind of got a little, like a kind of, like a little kernel of confidence back. But it feels like he's kind of built on it since then. So that one as well, I think. Well, but, you know, we'll see what Bale does to now and the end of the season. But if he ends up, you know, helping Spurs win Europa League and or get into the top four, then I think that might feel like quite a big moment.
Yeah, that Bale goal in the Wolfsburger AC away goal.
Yeah,
that was the that was one of the first ones I saw this season. I thought, hold on a second, that's Gareth Bale. It's not just some bloke in a Bale shirt, which is, you know, with all due respect, that was a little bit what it was like. You know, the first, his, you know, when he played like one game here and then out for 3 weeks and another game here and then back. And I know he scored two or three goals in that spell, but it wasn't like watching Bale. And then you watch that goal and it's like, yeah, that is literally Gareth Bale. So, yeah, that Kane goal was fantastic. And, you know, maybe you could argue that having Bale and Son in the team as well means that the Palace defenders are a bit more conscious of the other threats. And that means that Kane gets an extra half yard and that allows him to do stuff like that. I don't know if that's true. It kind of would make sense as an argument.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just an incredible goal. And again, just a reminder that I think sometimes people like to put Kane in a box as being maybe not the most talented player, but he works really hard. You know what I mean? Or maybe he's just someone who's got a great mentality.
Well, like that Frank Lampard thing of like having made Lampard the most comparison of the ability that he's got.
Yeah, people do make that Lampard comparison. I don't think it's a completely illegitimate comparison. I do think there's some continuities there, but there's also a lot of discontinuities. I think Kane is a much more talented player than Lampard was. And I think he's able to do like more just cool shit. Like, do you remember the goal that he scored? Do you remember the goal that he scored at Leicester in the game that Spurs lost in the like September-ish 2019?
Yeah.
Where Kane was falling over, running. I think he was running onto a through ball, fell over, and then like while he was on the ground, basically volleyed the ball into the floor. It's like an Ozil style finish. So it bounced up and over Kasper Schmeichel. Like he does really cool stuff, and you can see that in his passes as well, which are, you know, a lot of which are very inventive and precise, and just, he just tries things. He's got a real, he's a bit more like original and inventive and experimental as a footballer than he gets credit for. Like people just think he's a kind of dead eye goal scoring machine, and he is kind of that, but he's also not just that. He's more than that.
What's he up to now this season? Premier League, is it 16 or 17 goals?
16, one behind Salah, level with Bruno Fernandes. I was considering calling him Gilfie Fernandes, which is my joke, but then given that he scored that penalty against City yesterday, I think I'm going to not make any Fernandes jokes again for a while.
He's mugged you and Roy Keane right off there, isn't he?
Yeah, he has. So yeah, Kane one behind Salah, but I believe on the Premier League assists, he's top of the assists. He's on 13. Kevin De Bruyne
is on 11. It's all about goal contributions. That's what it's all about. That's the metric.
If you tweet about goal contributions, you'll get people tweeting you back saying it's actually not a very accurate way of measuring these things. But I don't know if it is.
As we record this now, shall I do a tweet about goal contributions and see if someone says something to me before the end of this podcast?
Someone who maybe doesn't get quite so many goal contributions, but who I want to mention on the pod, is Lucas Moura. Lucas, you know, it can't be fun being Lucas Moura at the moment because I don't know if he goes on Twitter much or listens to podcasts, but all he would hear is Spurs fans saying, oh, it's brilliant now. We've got Bale, Kane, Son and Dele. We finally got the front four that I wanted. And no, literally nobody says, oh, it's brilliant. We've got Lucas. I love Lucas. Like I feel like he is nobody's favourite Spurs player. And, you know, we've criticised him on this podcast before. I'm not sure if he would especially care. But Mourinho does like him. And even though Lucas was rested for the Fulham game, I actually thought he came on and was really, really good in that Fulham game. One of those changes that helped Spurs hold on to the lead, which I think was hugely important in the context of their season. And then he was rewarded for that performance in the Fulham game by starting the game yesterday. And I'm sure most Spurs fans would rather have seen Dele start or Lo Celso. You know, when I get asked about this question, I always say I'd rather see Dele or Lo Celso as a 10 and never even mention Lucas. And Lucas was really good yesterday, including, I thought Spurs were pretty rubbish for the first 20, 25 minutes. I thought they were flat and predictable and didn't look like creating anything. And it was Lucas who won the ball from Luka Milivojevic after about 20, 25 minutes to set Kane through, who set up Bale for the first goal. And if Lucas hadn't done that, then I think Palace were looking really, really comfortable. So I just want to say, James, hats off Lucas Moura. You are not as bad as some of us make out, especially on this podcast.
And, so humble.
Yeah, I can see that, you know, he obviously he's capable of making a big contribution to the team and not just in the kind of very occasionally bashing in great goals, which is generally his thing.
Yeah. Yeah, he did well. Well done, Lucas Moura.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Something else that I was thinking about the game yesterday was this was Spurs' best second half since Southampton, back when they scored four goals at St Mary's 6 months ago in that big win at the start of the season. And I think the reason they were so good is because they conceded a goal at the right time. Like, so many Spurs games this season have been ruined by Spurs going in at halftime 1-0 up, and in the second half they don't know what to do, and they sit back and 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 sit back, and then they concede an equaliser in the 85th minute. Like, it's happened against Fulham, Newcastle, Crystal Palace, Wolves. It nearly happened in the Fulham game at Craven Cottage on Thursday evening, which I went to. And, you know, if it wasn't for the Mario Lemina handball VAR thing, then Fulham would have made it 1-1, and who knows what would have happened next. So it nearly happened then. And I think if Spurs had got to halftime on Sunday evening at 1-0 up, then it might have happened again. But because they had the foresight to concede just before half-time to Christian Benteke's header, that meant that because they went in at half-time, they didn't have the option to sit back in the second half and try and defend and defend and defend and defend and defend and then concede a Connor Wickham header on 86 minutes, which I think would have happened. But because they went in at 1-1, they could attack in the second half. And because they could attack in the second half, they played brilliant football and won 4-1. So yeah, it's all about conceding at the right time so that you come out and have to come out and play again in the second half and not just defend. James, is that absolute bollocks or is that an incredible take?
I think it's absolute. So, just to clarify, so when they went 2-1 up, why did they not then defend after that?
Oh, just because they had the momentum and they were enjoying it. They were like, oh, wow, it's brilliant, this attacking football. Let's do more of it. Let's score some more amazing goals.
There have definitely been games where it's felt like Wolves, for example, away.
Yeah.
Where they so obviously like gave Wolves all the initiative when they weren't really especially good. And if they conceded in what was it, like the 94th minute or whatever.
Yeah.
And if they'd conceded in like the 68th minute, because they conceded and against Palace as well away they did this. They conceded late and then started playing again. You kind of think, well, if they'd conceded after like an hour, maybe they would have won 2-1. So I can kind of see the merit in that, but I'm not so sure that like scoring, conceding just before half time, I'm not sure if that's like led to them scoring 3 goals in the second half. I kind of see the point they're making, but I don't think it really holds much water.
Well, my tweet got a lot of likes and no tweet that, it must be true.
Should we check in on my metrics? Where are we?
Nothing.
Contributions. Yeah, just 4 likes for my goal contributions tweet so far.
No untrue tweet has ever been liked by many people on Twitter.
Yeah, nothing on social media. You're right. Yeah, nothing on social media has ever. Yeah.
Riddle me that. But I did want to like make a comparison between yesterday's game and Thursday's game at Craven Cottage, because Thursday's game at Craven Cottage, I thought what was interesting to me is that it followed the pattern. It largely followed the pattern of too many of the other Spurs 1-alls, except for the outcome was different. Except this time Spurs, you know, you could say Spurs got away with it. You could say Spurs defended much better. I thought that kind of one slightly bizarre moment aside, which led to Josh Marger's disallowed equaliser, I thought Spurs actually did defend pretty well. I think the defence is, I think Sanchez and Alderweireld are playing really well at the moment. Like, obviously, by the standard of Spurs centre-back pairings this year, which has obviously been a bit of a mess. But I think that game will go, I think the Fulham game will go down as a really important win.
I mean, I think so. I mean, look, we said before, you know, Fulham then went to go and win 1-0 at Anfield, and whatever you say about how Liverpool are playing at the moment, all those teams that have won there have generally had to play well to do that. And Fulham were very good yesterday. Fulham had, what, like a sort of 15-20 minute spell maybe from sort of early in the second half to that disallowed goal where they were obviously on top. But I actually thought after that, Spurs kind of sort of clicked into gear a little bit more after that. And yeah, they weren't like flying forward and creating loads of chances, but I thought they managed the game pretty well. And I think they put themselves in many awkward situations after that. I thought they generally kept the ball reasonably well, restricted Fulham to not especially good chances, I suspect, in XG terms. So, you know, yeah, I think you're right. I think you'll probably look at that at the end of the season. If Fulham, say, you know, if Fulham stay up, they'll probably stay up and finish like 15th, won't they? That's the kind of season it is. They'll like end up finishing really strongly, and then it'll kind of look like they were never really in trouble. So I think you'll look at going there and winning 1-0 as a decent result.
And also, I think Spurs did look really tired on Thursday. There's an interesting line from Hugo Lloris after the game where he was saying, you know, in the first half, Spurs were really aggressive and they did defend on the halfway line and they played high up the pitch and they really pressed Fulham, and that was great. It was, in the second half, they didn't have the energy to do that. And because they didn't have the energy to do that, they kind of almost overcompensated and had to drop all the way back to defend because they couldn't press, they also couldn't leave any space in behind. And that's why you had Spurs camped in their own box for most of the second half. But I should say, I thought the introductions of Lucas, Lamella and Sissoko in the second half of Fulham were really, really good and did give Spurs a lot of energy. You know, we've criticised Jose enough for his decisions and substitutions and what have you. So that, I thought, was a really good bit of game management. And those guys came on and helped get Spurs back up the pitch. And on another day, I think Spurs would have got another goal or two. There were definitely openings on the break there in the last 5-10 minutes. And now, you looking at those three games together, James, as you said, Spurs had to win all three of them after a pretty rubbish run in the league, and they did. And now the league is back in play. Like a month ago, I'd have said Spurs should put all of their eggs in the Europa League basket, play Kane and Son, all the top players against Dinamo Zagreb and whoever else, and just play the kids, play the B team in the Premier League because the Premier League's over. I don't think that anymore. I think the Premier League's back in play. I'm not, you know, they're not going to win the Premier League, but there's a reasonable chance they could come fourth. There's a pretty good chance they could come fifth, sixth. Europa League via the league, much better than Europa League via a cup competition.
That's bollocks, isn't it? It's better to win a cup than to finish
sixth. I know, it's more fun to win a cup, but it's more doable to finish sixth.
Yeah, probably, maybe. Fine.
Yeah.
But that's not what you said.
No, you're right, you're right. So, James, the question is, if you're Jose Mourinho, are your eggs in the Dinamo Zagreb basket or the Arsenal basket?
So I'm Jose Mourinho. I've got, how many eggs have I got? What are the eggs? I've got a lot of
eggs.
It
doesn't actually matter. Just think of eggs as like a concept.
It's Arsenal is like the worst game to ask this question. Like if it was, you know, if they're playing any other mid-table team,
hey.
It would be an easier question. But I mean, it'd be very good to, I mean, I'm sure Mourinho would love to do the double over Arsenal. I mean, that would definitely improve his standing among those kind of cynical people in the fan base. I'm sure there are some cynical people in the fan base. It should be possible to sort of win that Zagreb tie and also play a strong team against Arsenal, win that game. I mean, they'll be having the same conversations, obviously, as well, I know. You know, they've got, I think it's Olympiacos, isn't it? And also, what I think is quite interesting, and this, I don't know whether this will be a factor on Sunday, but Spurs were originally supposed to be away first, which traditionally is the way you want it to be. You want to go away first, get your away result, and then come and play the second leg at home when you know what you have to do. But that got flipped because Arsenal were also at home in the second game, and Arsenal had priority because they won the FA Cup last season, so they have like a higher ranking in the Europa League, whatever. So, I mean, obviously complete nonsense because there aren't fans at the game anyway, so there's no sort of logistical or policing issue there. They both could have played in the same week or at the same time, even. It wouldn't have mattered, but whatever. It might almost help Spurs out. They're not going to have to travel before that game. It might just work in their favour slightly when I think, obviously, Arsenal have to go to Greece and back on Wednesday, Thursday. Spurs will be kind of sat around North London for the week. I don't know. I might just be a very minor thing that might just help them a little bit. It might also kind of convince Mourinho to play a slightly stronger team in the first leg than he otherwise may have done, maybe. I think you probably want to like rotate a little bit. I mean, given he's left Ndombele out of the weekend, I guess you probably suspect he'll play Thursday. I don't know whether that means he then won't play on Sunday. I mean, I think we've talked about this earlier in the season, but Mourinho doesn't strike me as someone who kind of does that sort of Pochettino Pep thing of looking kind of six or seven games ahead, working out what his team is going to be for each of the next X games to work out who's going to be quote unquote in the red zone or whatever. He'll take each game as it comes, right?
Yeah.
So basically just pick a strong fit 11 for Thursday night and then see who's ready to play again on Sunday, I guess. I would like to see them rest a couple on Thursday night. I mean, I have a feeling Zagreb are going to be a decent team and that's not going to be an easy game. But I think now, you know, with Bale coming into form, Dele Alli looking like he's sort of starting to bubble under a little bit, you know, Son, Kane, and Ndombele, you know, you've got like Lamella and Lucas, who we talked about, who have done quite well in the last couple of weeks. Bergwijn, who you hope maybe is going to get some minutes somewhere. He should be able to kind of make some changes.
Yeah.
And still be able to play like decent teams in both games. So, I mean, I know the obvious answer is he's going to want to win all of those games.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like you can prioritise Arsenal a little bit, can't you? I mean, you know, if you draw, I mean, I know it's going to be very difficult to go away to Zagreb, but it's not going to be like fans. So it's, you're not going to have kind of all of the same issues that you otherwise would have had with that away day. So I just think maybe it's better to just kind of lean slightly towards Arsenal.
Yeah, maybe, I mean, like, this is just pure speculation, but maybe he would, I don't know, play Kane and Son and Bale for an hour on Thursday, try and see if Spurs can get 2 or 3 nil up.
Still then, 5 subs in Europe, isn't it, as well? Right,
I think so. Yeah, and then so play them all on Arsenal, and then if Spurs are clear, if Spurs have a really good margin through the first leg, then you can not send them to Croatia next week, and then just prepare them for Aston Villa next Sunday, which is a huge game. But
yeah. Just think, it'd be nice to beat Arsenal and to be 10 points ahead with 10 games left to be quite good, wouldn't it? I know we're kind of getting into negative spiral territory there, but it would be quite a nice time to beat them and open up quite a big gap.
This run they're on at the moment, they have to sustain it. Like if they were to go out of the Europa League or to lose to Arsenal or Villa, then I do think some of the negativity would come back in. But right now I have a positive feeling. I just want to wrap up the podcast with two questions we've got from readers, which I thought would both be quite good fun. First question is from Sean1982. What do you think of Kane taking free kicks? Can't remember him coming close, let alone scoring from one. Well, he hit the post, didn't he, against City in the 3-0 in February?
February, yeah.
And even that one when he hit the post, I think that was the best one he's taken since 2014.
The 2014 one that you're talking about is this, the one at Villa, right? For people who don't remember, it is, I think some people sometimes say it's Kane's first Premier League goal, but it's not. It's like the fourth, maybe the first of that season. Away at Villa in the last minute. But it's like he hits it straight into the wall and it kind of spins in off some chump like Nathan Baker or someone, I don't know, whoever it was. It wasn't like a particularly great free kick. It is what happened to go in. I don't think there's been loads since then to suggest that he's like a brilliant free kick taker, other than the fact that, you, like you say, he hit one very good one at Man City. I feel like Dyer's probably, like, in percentage terms, probably hit more good ones.
It's kind of a surprise that Kane isn't better than he is, because you would expect him to be good, but his record isn't great.
But he's very good at striking a ball, but when he takes a free kick, he tries to take it in a very different, like, tries to do it.
Do you think so?
I mean, this is going to make me sound like an old man, but if he just kicks it properly, you might score.
Harry, if you're listening,
stop trying to be Cristiano Ronaldo. We've got Gareth Bale to be Cristiano Ronaldo now.
Well, one more question before we wrap up. This one is from RichFlower85. He says, Hugo joined the 100 clean sheets club this week. Where does he rank against current Jock goalkeepers in the Prem? Also, how long do you think he will continue to be Spurs number one? In terms of current goalkeepers in the Premier League, well, I don't think he's the best. I think he'd have Alisson, Edison, Schmeichel ahead of him. I think Schmeichel's probably better. Who are the other good keepers? I can't actually think who the other good keepers are, James, at other teams.
De Gea or Henderson. Sort of, he's in that bracket. I'm still not 100% on Henderson. Like, I think it's one thing to... I mean, he was quite good yesterday. It's one thing to be very good playing for Sheffield United.
Yeah.
It's very different to be good playing for someone where there's the pressure of winning every game. He's in that bracket with De Gea, I think. Like, that's sort of his secondary group.
He's quite parallel with De Gea, isn't he, Lloris?
Yeah, so
he's obviously sort of a few years old. He's a few years older than De Gea, probably maybe 4 or 5 years older. But just in terms of coming to English football and basically being brilliant for years with incredible reflexes and everything. But now I feel like he's not that dominant. Like De Gea, I don't think he's really that good with his feet as he needs to be, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe that's being unfair on Lloris's kicking. I can't see Spurs getting rid of him. I just feel like transitioning between goalkeepers is something that you do incredibly reluctantly. Like, you do it every 10 years.
You say that, though. I think Spurs kind of churned through quite a few keepers in this sort of... I mean, I wouldn't be surprised... How long has he been there now? 9 years?
2012.
I wouldn't be surprised if, like, in the 9 years before that, where how far did that take you back to 2003? He probably went through like sort of 5 or 6 keepers in that time.
Yeah.
So, Casey Keller. Who would it have been after that? Paul Robinson. Gomez. Sort of a bit of Cudicini. Friedel.
Yeah.
Then Lloris.
Even after they signed Lloris from Lyon in 2012, remember AVB was reluctant to play him. So we had this weird kind of 3 months where everyone knew that Lloris would be the keeper. And AVB kept playing Friedel for basically, and he would always say, "Oh no, it's for respect." And
did you
spend money on this guy? Why would you not play him?
Were you covering Spurs? Were you covering Spurs that season?
Yeah.
Did you go to Lyon?
No.
So Spurs played away at Lyon, which is Lloris's old club, and Friedel played in a game. Maybe I got this wrong, and Friedel played in a home game, and it was the away fans of Boudin. But in one of the two games against Lyon, Friedel played. And Lyon fans booed him because Lloris wasn't playing.
And that situation just showed that it's difficult to change between keepers. And even though Lloris, I don't think, is the best keeper, like, when you have a keeper and a captain who's been at the club for that long, I think you kind of feel like you don't get rid of them unless the situation is absolutely dire. And so I reckon Spurs will... I mean, I think he's got another year left in his contract, maybe. I reckon Spurs will try and keep him. And also the fact is that literally all clubs in all of football are not going to be making big decisions on personnel, right, in the next year or two, because no one's got any money because of COVID. So any decision which you can punt down the line for 2 or 3 years, whether it's manager or players, that's what clubs are going to do. We're going to see a pretty dead transfer window this summer. I think most clubs are going to think, look, if we can just keep the players that we've got, we'll try to sell players and move some guys on, but it's going to be very difficult to do that. I think that will basically be what the market is like this year. I don't think there's going to be very much active decision making, or clubs are going to... not many clubs are going to launch a new cycle this year. It's just going to be more of the same next season. And maybe that dynamic will work for Mourinho as well, but, you know, that's a question for another week.
Up to 5 likes for my tweet now.
Well,
but no, no complaints.
No complaints. Well, shows what I know. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening and sending us your questions, especially Sean and Rich. Thank you, James. Thank you, producer Tom. We will be back again. More normal time, I think, next week, looking back on the Dinamo Zagreb and the Arsenal games. If you've got anything you want us to talk about next week, please just be in touch. We love all your tweets and comments and DMs, so keep them coming. And we'll see you next week.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.